And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, I've got Mark. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie. Well, you know, we had some northeasterly winds yesterday. They didn't actually move too much snow. They just kind of moved it around a little bit, but didn't form very deep slabs. There were a couple that were able to be triggered yesterday. So the only thing to watch out for, there won't be any heating to cause wet avalanches. There won't be a whole bunch of new snow today to cause avalanches in the new snow. Just a little bit of good skiing and riding to be found here and there. And overall, it's a low avalanche danger.
Okay. Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Doug Clyde. Later on, Sun Devil Basin Planning Commission Chairman Thomas Cook with an update on Tuesday's meeting. Finally, Heber City Manager Matt Brower with details about last night's interlocal meeting taking place with a number of Wasatch County entities. Summit County Council was scheduled to take action on the neighborhood mixed-use zone yesterday, but due to some scheduling technicalities, the item, along with the public hearing on the MPD process, was postponed. On the phone with details, I have Summit County Council member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first off, the two major items on the council were upended because of apparently an error in the county's public noticing. The council didn't take action on the mixed-use zone, although you did discuss it, and then the public hearing on the MPD process postponed entirely. So what happened?
I'm not entirely certain. We were just informed earlier in the day that somehow the MPD notice was incorrect, or that we weren't actually intending to take action on that piece, but it was noticed improperly. So that's really all I know. You know, how it got improperly noticed, I don't.
So when will the council hear the items again?
Well, we're going to be hearing them, I believe, in 2 weeks' time, and we want to collect comments from the public in the interim. So if there are people out there who have specifics about the NMU zone, in particular, because they're both tied together, the NMU and the MPD process. If you could get those to us electronically and specifically, that would be great, because we plan to go through it really sort of line by line.
Okay, so that is the April 7th meeting. The NMU discussion did bring up some major questions. Councilmember Roger Armstrong said he is for the zone, but he said if we don't get the details right, it will encourage growth and density. And to use his example, are we encouraging someone to build the Mall of America?
That conversation ran a little broad, I should say. I think by the time we got around to the discussion of the Mall of America, I was not paying particularly close attention, because none of this has anything to do with the Mall of America. That's just an absurd scenario. No, they're not growth inducing. Growth inducing is when we change the general plan, and we tell people that in the general plan we're going to put in new density, and perhaps apply that zone or apply another zone for an MPD process. Either way, then it becomes growth inducing. But just having the zone is not growth inducing. Matter of fact, the point of creating the zone is to make sure that what we have on the ground reflects more accurately what's shown in the code. Snyderville Basin in general has been pretty haphazard in the way that it was cobbled together over the decades. The underlying zoning under a large number of big commercial developments is residential. Makes no sense.
Hypothetically, could we allow a string of NMU developments along the Highway 40 frontage road?
No. No, that, and again, I think that was pretty much a red herring. The notion that if you build one large building, then you're obligated to build another large building next to it is not a notion that is supported in zoning law or in land. land planning concepts. That's just a complete misnomer.
So would we allow a mixed-use pod in the middle of some established subdivision?
No, probably not. And that's the whole purpose of going through the general plan and establishing where mixed use should be, right? We did that actually about 3 or 4 years ago. And that was a very long process. Took 4 or 5 years of countless outreach with the public. And we identified places in the general plan where we thought that mixed use could go if we received an application that we believe met our needs.
Ultimately, Community Development Director Pat Putt asked if the council wants to keep talking about the zone. The council said yes. I mean, Doug, why did you say then that the current process is haphazard, that it's a let's make a deal?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I must have misspoken. The zoning that is in place in Summit County is haphazard, right? We have Summit County from the very beginning has never developed zones that reflect the actual day-to-day operations of various entities. You know, we don't have a recreational zone, a mixed-use zone. We do things under commercial zones with a bunch of additional regulations because that's a zone that is available to us. The purpose of developing the MNU zone is to have a zone that represents a land use on the ground that, you know, currently, for example, we have in the Kimball Junction area. but we'd like to have the zoning represent the land use.
So is the council going to have some sort of existential discussion then about growth in the basin? I mean, given
that I don't think that we're going to have a large existential discussion about that. I don't think there's anybody on the council that that is in favor of growth. Matter of fact, a large part of the discussion last night was, you know, we're not going to approve developments just to get 20% affordable housing for the sake of affordable housing, because they, you know, that sort of growth actually is in fact cumulative and becomes a problem. You know, we're not necessarily going to be able to build our way out of this by convincing developers just to push you more affordable units in their projects.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because regarding affordable housing, council member Chris Robinson had said it's the problem du jour for the entire county. And you said that we will not solve the problem with sticks and bricks. So what did you mean by that?
I mean to say that that based on the way our current general plan is put together, and based on our requirements to integrate affordable housing into our communities, that is to make sure that affordable housing are not just standalone compounds. But in order to fully integrate affordable housing, we're just simply not going to be able to do that. You know, we're told that we need, you know, 1,200 units a year or whatever the number is. For the next 5 years, that's just not going to happen. It's physically not possible, and the county certainly is not going to to go into existing developments and become a new development authority. There just is, you know, this concept that somehow or another we're going to build our way out of this is just specious.
Councilmember Robinson also suggested that perhaps this 20% requirement of units that are approved must be affordable just isn't working. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that's right. I think that the contention. Back up. The history is, in the past, if you wanted to get a project approved in Summit County, and you came forward with a large affordable component to your plan, you probably had a pretty good chance of getting it approved. And those were in the days in which we were using that 20% number. But we know now that that 20% number probably barely covers the additional employment that is generated by the other 80% of the development. We're just chasing our tail with that number. I think what he was saying, and I believe what we all agree on, is just coming in with a 20% affordable housing component is not going to get you new density in Summit County.
Let's move to a public comment. Resident Jan Perkins suggested that Summit County set up a carbon tax to help finance open space in the Camas Valley. How likely is that, and would it get anywhere in the Utah legislature?
Glenn had some experience with that. Apparently, it has been an item that has been discussed in the legislature in the past. It has not been favorably reviewed, but we're making progress with the ledge on various environmental issues. We would certainly look into that and try and do what we could to promote it. we don't know whether there are two problems with it. One is it legally viable, and then is it economically viable? You know, can we pass a law? Can we pass a tax? And then the other thing is, if we do, are we going to gain any significant revenues from it? And it would be great if we had if we could, but I'm skeptical that we'd be able to generate huge piles of money.
Yeah. Well, let's see where we get with the local control argument first. Gail Pace, also curious about senior housing being mentioned in the Dakota Pacific discussion. Is that an idea that somebody just threw at the wall, or is it part of Dakota Pacific's plan?
They have not come to us yet with an actual unit by unit plan. I don't know at what point senior housing entered the Dakota Pacific discussion. We do know that there is demand. The question is always, can you build a facility in Park City which is affordable? And that's the big question. Affordable to seniors as well as and workforce housing for that matter. It's all the same problem, as it were. Yeah. So when that item came up, I'm not certain, but it senior housing comes up in virtually all our discussions about upzoning and increasing density within a parcel.
All right. Finally, I wanted to ask you, I mean, how do you feel about how the review of Dakota Pacific is going?
I think it's going well. Excuse me. It's a little bit chaotic because we have thrown them back to one of their earlier designs and said, look, we want to take a look at this because there appears to be more public benefit in one of their earlier iterations in terms of transportation, public spaces, and just making that a good mixed-use development. That's that. So.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think that's it, Leslie. Thank you.
All right. Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde. KPCW News Time now, 8:24. Well, Leadership Park City hosted Deer Valley and Alterra Mountain Company executives at Monday night's annual Community Leadership Lecture. The public got a glimpse into what might be in store for the resort in the coming years. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Deer Valley President Jeremy Levitt said although he took over at the helm of the resort amid the COVID-19 pandemic and on the eve of the most challenging winter in the resort's history, he's still eyeing ways to invest and improve the resort over the next 5 years. As KPCW has reported, the resort has had preliminary talks with Park City Municipal staff about the future of the Snow Park base area. Levitt said Snow Park is not the only capital improvement project they have their eyes on.
Things that I think about: renovating the lodges, the three-day lodges that we have. There's some other opportunities, the village and snow park. We have having internal discussions about what's going to happen there. We continue to engage in discussions with Mayflower. But all of this is to continue to invest back into the experience to make it better for the guests, as well as our staff.
Levitt stressed that any discussions about the snow park project have been largely conceptual thus far and added that transportation would be a key aspect of any future base development project, including integration with a transit center and possible aerial transit system that has been studied by city government. Although no timetable was offered, he said it would likely be some time before plans were finalized and construction began.
We are in active discussions right now. Obviously, an enormous project of significant scale. So making sure that the planning gets done right, making sure that the arrival experience and the food and beverage experience and the hospitality experience that we can deliver, really to deliver a base village that is worthy of Deer Valley. But there's a lot of things that's contingent on, and we're not putting a shovel on the ground anytime soon.
Alterra Mountain Company, which acquired Deer Valley in 2017, was represented at the lecture by Chief Executive Officer Rusty Gregory. Gregory addressed the company's relationship with the Mayflower development to the east of Deer Valley along the Jordanelle Reservoir. The possibility of a partnership between the forthcoming Mayflower Mountain Resort and Deer Valley has been hinted at in the past, given the proximity of the resorts and property boundaries near the base of the Mayflower chairlift. Gregory said talks are ongoing between Deer Valley and Mayflower, but no agreements have been reached yet. He added the community will have a chance to see any future plans before changes are made.
We've spent a lot of time with Extel. I've gotten to know Gary Barnett quite well, and we're having discussions about what role Deer Valley can play in the ski terrain that is available potentially with adjacent Mayflower land and some terrain that is not offered today. And Gary's very interested in that, as well as the real estate at the bottom that he owns. So we're having discussions on how we might be able to combine efforts, and then once we do come up with some idea with it, that'll be back in front of the community and we'll see how the community feels about it.
The Mayflower development is expected to break ground as early as later this spring. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission Tuesday night recommended approval for the code amendments regarding accessory dwellings. On the phone, I have newly named Commission Chairman Thomas Cook. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Leslie.
So how does the group feel about the basic numbers for minor accessory buildings? We've got a principal structure up to 2,000 square feet and then a secondary structure up to 400 square feet, major accessory buildings up to 12,500 square feet, and a height limit of 26 feet.
Well, I mean, I think the commission that was present for the meeting and the public hearing feels good enough that, we've added some predictability and methodology in how, how we consider accessory buildings, whether they're appropriate for the neighborhoods. In the specific numbers you're asking about, those are things that have been absent in the code in the past. I think previously, I think we had 15,000 was, allowed as a CUP, and we've had some problems. I'm going on my fourth year, and we've seen problems with, accessory buildings creating tension with neighbors and neighborhood plans. So I think what staff and Planning Commission have come up with provides some, applies a little bit of math to the predictability of how we consider, what can be allowed as an accessory building.
Yeah. I mean, the horse is already out of the barn with them, no?
Well, that's a great analogy you picked, because it's usually the horse barns that are, you know, have caused us the greatest consternation in residential neighborhoods. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, the horse is out of the barn. I think you can look at this in a couple of ways. You know, one way to look at it is that every 5 years we're required by state statute to revise our general plan, or at least review it and make changes as needed. And, you know, the general plan is our visionary document. The code is the regulatory companion to that. And part of our general plan is, you know, to make sure, you know, there's a mandate from council and there's provisions in the general plan that instruct us to make the code as clear and predictable and easy to understand as possible. And, you know, in lieu of having very few restrictions, I think we have worked with staff to come up with some common sense ones. And nobody has a crystal ball to know how this is going to be implemented. And, you know, to answer your question about how we feel about it, I can't predict how council is going to feel about it, but we've taken a crack at applying some things that seem reasonable, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. And I guess just in terms of fairness, I mean, it's just not a fairness issue. I mean, the early bird got the worm here, and you'll just, those who waited will just have to deal with the new amendments then?
I mean, you could say that about any time the code and the general plan is updated. You know, there are going to be things that I think it's curious that, you know, it's curious to me that, you know, we revise these land use plans and code. And sure, we can always look in the past and say, well, this person got to do this, so why can't I do it? But, you know, this comes with the territory of trying to maintain our livability in our neighborhoods and continue, you know, to ensure that the basin is a desirable place to live. And, you know, the last general plan was adopted in 2015, and you know as well as I do how many changes we've undergone in the last 5 years. So, you know, I think it's important to make sure that our code and our general plan reflect the community's vision, and then we have a way, you know, we have a way to apply that and regulate it.
What about Debbie Scoggins' suggestion that the county require these accessory structures to be clustered around the main building?
Debbie Scoggins, the former planning commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, clustering is a great, it's a great principle that we aspire to and apply in other cases. And I think that comment from Debbie probably raised the most interest. I mean, we had two comments in the public hearing. One member of the public thanking us for the approach that was taken, and then Debbie's comments. And I think Debbie was onto something with the clustering. I think our conversation identified that it's a little maybe tougher to do that in practice. You know, when you have an existing structure and you're adding an accessory building versus, you know, when you're looking at a vacant piece of bare dirt saying, how can I best plan out my house and my horse barn and my, you know, whatever sprinter van shed. I think, you know, one of the things that's important is that council has asked us to be thorough, but also move fast. And we're sort of operating under the 80-20 rule where we get something that we think is 80% good and may have some other areas of consideration to get it to them and highlight what those things are for them to work out. And, you know, I think the clustering is certainly one of those ideas that Debbie, you know, brought up that had some traction with the commission.
Yeah. She also brought up, well, the lights intrude on our night sky, and should there be landscaping to shield the buildings? Where did you guys come down on that?
Well, we have our dark sky lighting ordinance, so certainly that's going to apply to any new anything new that's built. And then, you know, there's a provision in the lighting ordinance where, you know, there's a period of time where older lighting will have to be brought into compliance. But yeah, I guess we're always concerned about lighting, but that's why we did the lighting code. So I think there's some measures there. What was the other thing? The other thing you mentioned was
just landscaping important. To shield the buildings.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So that's, you know, I think that the language of the ordinance, that, we're proposing to council does give the planning commission a little bit of latitude in approving, accessory buildings in the future, that would allow us to consider things like us reciting for, you know, if something's too close to a setback and it might impact neighbors. And you know, as far as landscaping goes, the major accessory buildings are still would still be approved under a CUP process where, you know, we could consider mitigation impacts, mitigation measures to mitigate impacts. And, you know, landscaping could be something that's requiring landscaping could be something that that we might require on a larger major accessory building.
Yeah, there were some other questions. I mean, if there's a detached garage, how is that covered by the accessory building code?
Yeah. I brought that one up because we're talking about garages and detached garages and minor accessory buildings and major accessory buildings. And so you could imagine a scenario where, you know, somebody might say about an attached garage, well, we don't have a definition for that. And it's a garage, it's not an accessory building. So little things like that, you know, we went back to the planning staff to say, you know, please consider this, please consider tightening this up. And I think that will be done before it even gets to council.
All right. And then the issue of steel containers, does the commission want to ban them entirely or should they be allowed for some uses?
Well, that's a great question. You know, we this isn't the first time we've talked about steel containers, shipping containers. And, you know, for the record, nobody from the shipping container lobby showed up to lobby in favor of them. I do think that the county gets their fair share of complaints from neighbors that, you know, they're unsightly and they don't do anything to add to the visual environment. But that was something that came up in our meeting, was that the language of the proposed code amendments prohibited shipping containers as an accessory building, but it really doesn't do anything to prohibit shipping containers. And so that's a question for staff. What are we trying to do? Are we trying to ban shipping containers throughout, or are we trying to ban them being used and repurposed as an accessory building? That wasn't entirely clear in the meeting, so we're going to figure that out.
All right. And then finally, I mean, as the new chairman of the commission, how do you feel about some of the recent agendas? I mean, we've had meetings for 6 or 7 straight hours. Is there a way to lessen the workload? I mean, some would say that's a form of growth management right there.
Well, it's precisely why I made a commissioner comment at our previous meeting that I think, you know, while we're working on general plan and code amendments, we should consider similar to how the council requested a temporary zoning ordinance to, you know, to stop the permitting of new accessory buildings till we figure this thing out. I think on the more global scale, you know, if you look at the more complicated issues that generate the most public input, they're things like rezones. And so I don't think it's a bad idea to pump the brakes a little bit on major applications while we are doing our code and general plan review and amendments. But I think it's never okay for us to go past, you know, as volunteers from 4:30 to midnight in a meeting ever again. I'm just not exactly sure. We've not proven very successful at managing that.
Okay.
Leslie, I will say one thing. You know, there's a much talked about debate about how this sort of COVID era Zoom you know, Zoom public hearing thing has created a lot of new engagement that, you know, people in the past maybe are limited by how many parking spaces there are at the Richens building or how many seats there are, you know, to come and speak about something they care about. And so we are trying to balance and manage, you know, the good and bad of the Zoom meetings. The good is you can have as many people come and give comment as you have time for. The bad is really the same thing, right? So we just have to do better at managing those big meetings with all the other stuff we need to do.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Thomas?
I don't think so.
All right. Appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Members of the Heber City Council, the Wasatch County Council, Wasatch School Board met in an interlocal meeting last night on the phone with a recap of some of those issues discussed. I have Heber City Manager Matt Brower. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks. You personally covered several agenda items. Let's start with the Dark Sky Initiative. You had said that one of the key things heard in the Envision Heber process is that residents want to preserve the night sky. So the first step sounds like it's been taken by Heber City, which is to adopt a night sky ordinance. What's next?
Yeah. Let me backtrack just a moment. During Envision Heber 2050 planning, we heard time and time again that one of the top priorities of the community was to preserve that night sky. So Heber City has put a strategy that has really three areas of focus. First is to put an ordinance in place that would require all new development to comply with really best practices for preserving the night sky. And that's been done, that's been put in place by the Heber City Council. The next part of our strategy is to begin looking at the existing lights and how we can retrofit them to come in compliance with night sky requirements. And then the third leg of the strategy is partnering with our local community members, Midway and Wasatch County and others, to make sure that we all have the same ordinance. Because if one part of the community is complying with the ordinance and the others are not, of course, that would eliminate or dismiss some of the effectiveness of our strategy.
Right. So when you talk about residents having to retrofit the existing lights on their property, who pays for that?
Yeah, we're not talking about existing residents retrofitting their lights. We're talking about Heber City retrofitting its lights, for example, street lights, for example, the lights on its facilities, and trying to set the example for maybe others to follow. So this ain't about asking existing residents to retrofit. It's about Heber City retrofitting.
Okay, so you just can plan ahead for that just in capital budget then, huh?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you mentioned, you're working with communities to get on the same page. What was the response from the others at last night's meeting?
Very warm. They accepted the invitation to begin a dialogue and to compare and contrast our existing night sky ordinances and make sure we're all on the same page.
Great. Let's see. Another item on the agenda is to engage the school district and county partners to adopt a CRA along Midway Lane, Historic Main Street, as well as the Heber Creeper. So tell us what a CRA is.
A CRA is it's an acronym that means Community Reinvestment Agency. It's a tool that local governments can use to generate what's called tax increment. And that increment can then be reinvested in the area or the agency area. What this allows for is for local governments to begin realizing more investment, which then hopefully spurs more private investment. And in the case of Heber, what we hope to do is really transition our downtown into an area of destination, as well as the area around the Heber Creeper. So this ain't a new tax. This is simply capitalizing upon tax increments or increased tax values to hopefully really turn our downtown into a place of destination where people want to shop and dine and enjoy the plays and other activities that we might have.
So is that the first goal there, the Heber Creeper area?
So the project area includes essentially old downtown Heber, includes Midway Lane, and the area in and around 6th West and I believe, 6th West and Midway Lane. It's essentially where the Heber Creeper is. Heber Creeper is the number one tourist attraction in our county, and so we feel like that area really needs some attention and some investment.
Okay, so it sounds like the Lieutenant Governor's Office has approved the initiative at this point?
That is correct. One of the first steps that local governments have to achieve is they have to get the Lieutenant Governor's Office to sign off on the strategy, and in our case, we've got that approval. Our next step is to begin identifying the project area plan and the project area budget. And then the third step, which would run in parallel with the second step, is to negotiate interlocal agreements with the county and the school district.
So is there some interest, given that they are already having that tax increment come out of their budgets due to the Mayflower Resort project?
So with a tax increment, the district and the county would not receive any less tax revenues. And what we intend to do in the interlocal agreement is make sure that they get some portion of the tax increment. So they would not only remain whole, but they'd get some additional tax revenue. And at the end of the life of the CRA, they would literally get a windfall of all the existing tax increment that's been generated through the life of the agency.
Wasatch County Council Member Kendall Crittenton mentioned that he was concerned about that tax increment going towards affordable housing. Could it?
Absolutely. In fact, state law is that 10% of the tax increment has to be dedicated to affordable housing. And in some initial conversations with the county and with the school district, we've indicated that it'd be appropriate to invest in some housing for our teachers and firefighters and police officers. Prices for housing in Wasatch County has only gotten higher and higher, making it difficult for our community's heroes to find a place to live. And so we see that as one of the top priorities of the CRAs, to ensure that we honor the state law and we invest that 10%, if not more, to help with some of the critical affordable housing needs.
So are you moving forward with this then, drafting the interlocal agreements?
Yeah, we hope to meet with both the county and school district in the next few weeks to start that process. And that will take obviously some time and to work through those agreements. And those agreements are critical to the CRA in order for it to be really successful.
And has that historic Main Street, has the CRA, the area, been established then? You mentioned the kind of the boundaries. Is that officially established though?
It is on paper, it is identified, but it would be formally established when we create the agency resolution, which is a subsequent step. And so we've got approval from the state. The next step is really the interlocal agreement. And then, of course, we then certify the boundaries and start hopefully collecting the increment.
All right. You also talked a little bit about the open space initiatives underway, commenting about the 400-acre Red Ledges open space designation. It sounds like this is close to closure, but some confusion about how it will be managed. How are the open spaces being managed?
Well, that's the question we're trying to answer. When Red Ledges was developed, they were obligated to dedicate, I think it was 400 acres to perpetual open space. And then more recently, the city entered into a development agreement with what's called the Sorenton property, about 8,000 acres. And they've obligated to dedicate about 5,500 acres to perpetual open space. So the questions are naturally coming up. Who will provide the stewardship? Who will provide the management? Who will hold the conservation easement? And so we've committed to meet next week and start addressing those questions so that we can properly maintain that land and make sure that it stays pristine forever.
Yeah, here in Summit County, we've used the Summit Land Conservancy or Utah Open Lands. Is that an option for you?
I think they are viable options for holding the conservation easement. But the other questions are, who would provide the management of the land? Would that be the conservancy districts? Would that be the county? Would that be the city? And what's the cost for doing that? And then who pays for that cost? And so there's some administrative issues we've got to get our hands around and make some decisions on.
All right. Some of the other items discussed, one of those, the RAP tax, how did those participating respond to instituting a RAP tax?
Very positively. During the Heber City Council retreat in January, my council identified the RAP tax as an important priority to try to get on the ballot for this November. And the state law says that we have to get the county council's approval before we can do that. Well, the county council has also expressed some interest in maybe partnering with the city and Midway to do a countywide RAP tax. And so it was very warmly received last night. And a lot of input about putting on the ballot for November.
All right, and then you've got a deadline by June to decide if that happens. Have you kind of tested the waters with the public? Because they have to vote on it.
That is absolutely correct. So the voters have to approve it, and that would be placed on the November ballot. There's still a lot of administrative steps that we've got to do. We've got to verify how much revenue it might generate. We have to identify where that revenue would be invested. But the positive aspect of the wrap tax is the vast majority of it would be paid by people that don't live in our county, essentially by visitors. They come in to shop or purchase things, so they pay that tax, and they would go home, and we'd benefit because that tax money would stay here. And so the natural question is, do we want to take advantage of the sales tax that's generated predominantly by people that live outside the area to improve our parks and our recreation opportunities and perhaps some of the arts in our community? And so I think it's a fair question to put to the voters.
Yeah. Did you come to some consensus about how the funds would be distributed?
That's one of the administrative decisions we have to make, is to identify how those funds would be invested. And that is something that would be part of the ballot initiative that would be decided upon in November. So that's some work that we still have to do.
All right. Affordable housing discussed. Again, Midway Mayor Celeste Johnson mentioned that she's upset with the legislative overreach this session because they're telling municipalities that anyone can build a duplex anywhere, but not really addressing the affordable housing issue, just kind of giving developers the leeway to build whatever they want, wherever they want, regardless of the city zoning. So what's this all about?
Affordable housing is becoming a very acute issue, not just in Wasatch County, but the entire state of Utah. In fact, Governor Cox, I think 2 weeks ago, indicated that through the entire state of Utah, only 2,000 homes were for sale, when normally you'd have between 10 and 20,000 homes for sale. And so the demand for homes is rising rapidly, but the product or the number of homes isn't keeping pace. And of course, cost of homes are just skyrocketing. And so we have to ask the question, how are we going to provide for homes for our teachers and our firefighters and of course, nurses and others? And the legislature is certainly aware of the affordable housing crisis and is trying to do what they can to facilitate some solutions. But in the process of doing so, they are stepping on some toes, perhaps, with cities and trying to preempt some of their authority and land use laws. And so it's an ongoing conversation we're having, and it's one that's going to be a hard nut to crack. But if we work together, I think we can do it.
All right. And was there anything with regard to the Olympic update?
Yeah, Mayor Potter sits on a committee, and she simply reported out on the status of the work. State of Utah is looking to submit a application for, I think it's either the 2030 or 2034 Olympics, and trying to put the application together to hopefully get awarded those Olympics.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Yeah. Just wanted to make sure that everyone's aware of our airport open house that's slated for April 1st at 6 o'clock. It will be a virtual meeting because Wasatch County is still in an intermediate transmission level for the COVID-19. But I invite everyone to go to HeberValleyFlightPath.com and get more information about the open house and the virtual invitation that will be on there as well.
So will you be taking public input?
We will. We're actually inviting folks to submit their questions early. We'll also take some questions during the open house. And so if you go onto the website and submit your question, we'll get to it during the open house.
All right, Matt, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
That's Heber City Manager Matt Brower. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW, News Time Now, 8:56. Well, there were multiple attempted vehicle and home burglaries reported to the Summit County Sheriff's Office Monday morning. Keeping vehicles and doors locked, removing your valuables and keys are ways that residents can help prevent becoming victims of theft. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more on that.
The incidents occurred in Blackhawk Station, Spring Creek neighborhoods, and the Canyon Creek condos. A witness told sheriff's deputies they saw a red car, possibly a Nissan, in the area at about 4:45 a.m. Summit County PIO Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright said they took reports on five incidents that morning.
Additionally, we've had some stolen vehicles. There's one specific that happened within the last couple of days. A red Nissan Altima, I believe it was stolen from a residence, and that vehicle, or a vehicle very similar, was reported to have been seen in the area of where some of these other vehicle break-ins have taken place.
Another auto theft occurred with the victim discovering his car was gone when he attempted to auto start his vehicle. He went outside and realized it was gone. The victim said he had left his key in the unlocked car. Wright said they use a national registry to help identify stolen vehicles, and the sheriff's department has a new license plate reader that can help with recovery.
We do have one vehicle that has what's called a license plate reader that is constantly scanning license plates, just out in public, general public areas, whether it's a roadway or a parking lot or whatever. And it's running information very quickly to see if there are any stolen vehicles or wanted persons, which speeds up the process of us locating stolen vehicles or whatnot.
Earlier in March, a vehicle burglary incident occurred. The complainant told deputies someone took his firearm from the console in his unlocked pickup truck.
Firearms, that's a big deal to leave a firearm in a vehicle, especially unlocked. Valuables in general, it's a good reminder, such as taking out your valuables when locking your doors day and night, keeping your garage door closed day and night.
Wright said they have videos from two different complainants which show the same suspect checking door handles.
It's so common nowadays for people to have the different video doorbells or even just cameras on the exterior of their homes that are watching their driveways and their front doors, stuff like that. People having that technology, and because it's so widely used now, it is a very great investigative tool.
On the videos, the suspect rode a three-wheeled electric scooter with headlights. It appears to be an adult male wearing a hooded sweatshirt with reflective lettering on the back and a black flat-brim hat. They think he is wearing gloves and dark pants.
What we have found, just, you know, history usually repeats itself. We usually find that the people that are doing this are usually the same people or groups that are coming into the area and committing the crime and leaving.
Wright asks the public to call immediately, no matter the time of day, if they see something suspicious in their neighborhood. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.